This is Steve Maxner conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Daryl Nelson. I am at Texas Tech University, Lubbock, Texas, and he is in Kingman, Arizona. It is the 18th of July, year 2000, at 12:10 p.m. All right, Mr. Nelson, would you please begin by giving a brief biographical sketch of yourself?
Okay. My name is Daryl Nelson. I was born in Prosser, Washington in November 1940. I grew up in the Yakima Valley. I grew up with my uncles and my aunts and my grandparents. I didn't have a father. I went into the Army when I was 24 years old, and I was being drafted for some reason, even though I was married and had two kids. So rather than be drafted, I decided that I would try to have some say over my own career. I enlisted and went into the military police.
Okay. Now, what year was that you received your draft notice?
1964, for the 21st day of January, 1965.
Okay. Now, had the Gulf of Tonkin incident occurred yet, do you recall?
I don't recall.
Oh, okay. So you conducted your basic training, your boot camp, basic training at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Company C, 5th Battalion, 2nd Training Regiment.
What was that training like?
Well, the training was almost adequate. I say almost adequate because I went through a cycle and we had a lot of new drill sergeants, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And my drill sergeant, great man by the name of Sergeant Glenn Falls. It was his first cycle, and he was young. He was younger than I was, and he was a good instructor on some things, but other things he sort of let slip.
Mm-hmm. What were the things that he let slip, do you recall?
Yes, the combat end of the training.
Oh, okay.
Most of the training we had, the marksmanship training, was hampered by a lot of fog.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my problems from that day until this day is they taught us to shoot for a score, not for kills.
Okay.
Their idea was knock the target over to make sure you get the target. Shoot in front of it if you have to kick rocks into it.
Okay. So to knock the target down, you could kick up debris.
Yes, you can shoot... And these so-called kill targets,
yeah.
They have a problem with them now with the 223 because they're so rapid they'll go right through them.
Mm-hmm.
But with the old M14, if you hit them, they went down.
Mm-hmm.
But also, if you shoot in front of them and hit rocks and dirt, you got a much better chance of knocking the target down.
Okay. Yeah, which is not very realistic training for combat. Excuse me, did you talk about that kind of stuff with the other trainees?
Oh, a couple of us did, but in those days, about 80% of the people were draftees. They could care less.
Mm-hmm. They were in for the 2 years.
I'm going to do my 2 years, whatever it takes to get through, and I'm out of here.
Mm-hmm. Do you recall about how many people were voluntary enlisted like you versus the draftees, an approximate percentage?
I can't. I can tell you this, that my company was made up of a lot of draftees.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was, in my platoon,
mm-hmm.
there's a young man by the name of Livingston, and myself. There were three prior service people,
mm-hmm.
and the rest, I think, were draftees. Enlisted Reserve, Enlisted National Guard.
Okay. Did they, by the time you got into training, what month and year did you begin your basic? Do you recall?
Yes, I began it in February because I went to a week leadership school, and my basic training, I was a platoon guide.
Okay. So it was February 65.
Yes, sir.
So the Gulf of Tonkin incident had occurred. Talk about escalating the American presence in Vietnam was occurring. Was there much talk about Vietnam during your basic training?
There was quite a bit of talk about it, but there was only one person, one drill sergeant that had been to Vietnam.
Okay. What did he say about it? Did he mention it much? Or?
He, you know, it was the war story type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was hard to understand, and he talked about it. And the main thing I can remember him talking about was a great M60 machine gun.
Hmm. Okay. Did he say what his position was while he was in Vietnam?
I don't remember, sir.
Yeah, okay. All right, and what about how well this training prepared you for what you would eventually encounter in Vietnam?
I say very poorly. One thing that I would like to emphasize and on this in the training, we had a young man from Chicago by the name of Tom O'Hara, who was an enlisted reservist, and he was a type of record miler runner. He did not have to do the physical training the rest of us did, because push-ups evidently slow down your running. And when he took his combat proficiency test, the PCPT test, he ran the track by himself. He didn't have to. There's nobody else out there. They were out after numbers and records. They weren't really, how well were we trained?
Hmm. Were there other examples of, you mentioned already the marksmanship issue. Now this one with this individual in terms of running versus push-ups. Any other examples or where the emphasis seemed to be more on generating good statistics for the unit rather than emphasizing training?
Yes. We had a football player for a short time in a unit. He was a professional football player, and I cannot remember his name or what team he played for. And every place he went or everything he did, he got sort of specialized service, shall we say. In the mess hall, he didn't have to go across the horizontal ladder before he went in to eat. He didn't have to know the general orders or any of that stuff, his chain of command. You know, he'd just sort of take it to one side and slip through the line. He got recycled because of he got pneumonia or an upper respiratory infection. Most people with upper respiratory infections, unless it was real bad, they went to training, but not him. This gentleman was taken out and taken and put into a special unit. I understand he went to the hospital and was in some kind of unit up there for 4 or 5 days and then was recycled into another unit.
What did you and the other trainees, you know, did you talk about the special treatment that some of these people were getting?
Nope.
No? Huh. Okay. Well, what about your AIT? After you finished basic training, you went on to, since you went to MPs, to MP training.
Yes, I went to Fort Gordon, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a 2-week leadership school, and I was destined as a squad leader. The military police training at in Georgia was, I always felt geared toward how pretty can you look. We had very little combat trainings or tactics. We were taught basic convoy driving, and items like this. Every week we had a pass and review, and we practiced that 3 times a week. I always felt that my training could have been better in the use of a 45 caliber hand weapon. I could have had a little better training in that. Could have had more time in the physical aspects of what combat training is like.
What about things like, population control, riot control, the kinds of things that you might expect to encounter in a country that is at war. You know, we have refugees and you've got people moving around, milling around. The types of things that you would expect to encounter. Did you have training that addressed those types of issues?
Nope.
Wow.
Our bivouac, just to give you an idea,
The
platoon sergeant came around and told us, don't fire the blanks in your weapons, because if you have to clean them so meticulously after firing, just don't fire.
Now, what weapons were these again?
M14.
They felt that way about the M14?
Oh, yes.
Don't fire blanks. Because you have to do too much cleaning. Well, when did you finally get introduced to the M16? Was that in Vietnam?
That's quite a story, sir.
Okay, was it in Vietnam? If it
yes.
was, let's wait until we get to Vietnam then. Okay.
Well, I was introduced to the M16 very briefly in Class 65, 13 OCS.
Oh, in OCS. Okay. Well, let's finish with the MP training, then we'll move on. Did you go to OCS immediately after MP training? Or?
No.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
What did you do in between?
Well, after I finished my military police AIT, I was sent to a special weapons depot in Germany.
Okay. Oh, yeah, okay. That's right here. The 556th MP Company, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
It was in Siegelberg, Germany.
Okay. And then after that, you went back to the United States or in OCS.
I was chosen by my commander because of my scores and my gung-ho attitude, as it was said, because I wanted promoted. I was wanted more money.
Okay. Well, you had a wife and two children, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And that's the reason I wanted promoted, to better their quality of life. So I tried to be a better soldier than the average. And that caught my commander, a Captain Gerald Fix, and he sent me to a OCS board. And at first I was going to turn down the OCS board, and I was told, you don't have a choice. You're going to go, and you need to pass it. So I did.
Okay.
And then I was sent to Class 6513 at Fort Benning, Georgia.
Okay. Gotcha. Now, get back to your MP training real quick, just to make sure that we've got everything that's relevant. Was there anything else that occurred in your MP training that was noteworthy or important or that did help when you finally got to Vietnam?
I can't think of a thing, sir.
Wow.
We were trained more for stateside or European duty. In 1965, 66, early 66, there was not a lot of military policemen in Vietnam. I think that if I remember right, one of my platoon sergeants later in life told me in 1965 there was one company of MPs and they were in all of Vietnam, one company.
Okay.
Now, I don't know if he's right or not.
Well, yeah, I wouldn't be surprised by that number, given the small size of the force at that time. But, okay. Did they talk about Vietnam during your MP training at all?
Very briefly. One of the instructors at Fort Gordon, rather, mentioned Vietnam, and then the training on traffic control points. He was telling us that vehicles going toward the fighting or the front had the right of way, and if you were on a traffic control point, vehicles coming down, you waved them through when you could, and then he made a little joke, and he said, if one with a red star comes on, you best start running.
Okay. So not very constructive instruction.
Nope.
Okay. Anything else that you'd like to talk about with the MP training?
Well, I kind of thought it was a farce. I was really disappointed.
So you went from AIT to Germany, and what was your duty assignment when you were assigned to the 556th MP Company in Germany?
I was a security guard.
Mm-hmm.
I worked towers.
Mm-hmm.
And being that I wanted to better myself and took more pride in my uniform, I was also a main gate guard.
Mm-hmm.
I was also on the limited access gate. And a couple of three times I was on the what they call the passive active security, where we drove around the inside of the installation,
mm-hmm.
the controlled area,
mm-hmm.
with a Jeep and a machine gun.
Mm-hmm. With ammunition?
Oh, yes. We had live ammunition every time we went on duty.
Mm-hmm. What were the biggest concerns or threats that you as MPs faced in Germany while you were there?
Boredom.
Okay.
Well, you go into a tower for 10 hours a day, sir.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have any reading material. You can't have any reading material has to pertain to your post.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have cigarettes. You can't have a lighter. You couldn't have a radio. And the only thing we had for communication was an old crank telephone that worked occasionally.
Mm-hmm. But threats in the context of criminal activity, terrorism or communist infiltration, typical, Cold War type of scenario in Germany in the 60s. What, as MPs, were you briefed on things that you were supposed to be looking for or potential threats that existed?
Potential threats was people trying to sneak into the installation, into the secured area.
Mm-hmm.
People trying to subvert us,
mm-hmm.
like one time a guy in a bar got to asking a lot of questions, so my partner and I that was in town, we went back and told our CO, come to find out he was from military intelligence, and he was trying to do his job and see if we were going to talk to him, and we did our job and reported him.
Wow, okay.
The biggest threat, we had people that got confused where they were at, and once in a while would wander toward the fence. The most exciting thing we had was an unauthorized helicopter flight, came in one afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an American helicopter, and they were bringing something down to the restricted area.
Mm-hmm.
They were not cleared to land. They did not land on a helipad. Instead, they landed right out by my gate, at which time I promptly locked and loaded my .45 and put them both on the ground, took their weapons away from them. And the pilot of the helicopter said, and this is a quote, "Christ, I just came back from a year in Vietnam, and this is the closest I've came to dying yet."
What was it that they were actually there for?
They were on an authorized mission to bring something into the restricted area.
Mm-hmm.
I have no idea what it was. Mm-hmm. I was never told what was in the bunkers, and I never wanted to know.
Yeah. Any other interesting events while you were in Germany?
Yeah, there was one of our people in our company went to one of the little villages outside and got fired up, drunk, if you will, and he decided to come back and take a shortcut and hit straight into our fence area, and he came pretty close to getting shot. For his antics, he was court-martialed and sent to a white hat unit where he could patrol town.
How about any incidents of actual subversion?
None that I know of.
Yeah. And any particular criminal activity that was a problem, either in the base or just in the community just outside of it?
There was some black marketeering that went on, nothing spectacular, a few cartons of cigarettes I knew of. Some guys sold some film one time. They bought 35mm film in the PX and sold it to some Germans down at the guest house.
But the film had nothing on it.
Nah, it was blank film. It was just film to be taken, and it was higher speed than the Germans could get, or cheaper, or something. I don't remember.
Oh, I see.
There was one incident that happened, an accident that really stuck in my mind. Two of the gate guards were practicing their quick draw. And one of them sat down at the desk to do something. The other one was continuing his quick draw. And somewhere or another, the .45 discharged and hit the gentleman sitting at the desk in the back of the head.
Oh, goodness.
And while we all figured he was dead when we heard about it, the bullet did not enter the skull. It did fracture the skull. And put pieces of the skull into the brain. But the bullet traveled around the right side of the skull and came out almost directly between his eyes.
Wow.
The only things that happened was after his recuperation, of course he was discharged, but he lost part of his memory of things that had happened. And I have never run into him since, so I don't know what it was in later life. But the individual that did it was court-martialed and given a general discharge.
Well, any other major accidents while you were there?
That's the only one I can think of. It was a major one. There was some minor accidents with vehicles that some people got messed up a little bit, but nothing like that.
Yeah. And what were the rules about your interaction with the civilian population outside the base, and what was the relationship like between the German civilians and the American military personnel?
Well, I always thought that they were pretty good. The relationship, we could go to town, we could do anything we wanted, we were just told, keep your mouth shut about what you're doing. And we did.
There wasn't any kind of there wasn't a tense relationship or any animosity or anything like that between Americans and Germans that you witnessed?
Well, there was some problems between the Germans and the Americans. But the problems I can tell you about were because of the American GI's way of doing things. We were in a foreign country that some of them, they acted like they were better than anybody else. The GI's did. And they'd go get drunk and want to fight and, you know, stupid stuff.
And that was just kind of the biggest problem that you saw? Just some Americans that just misbehaved or acted arrogant?
Yeah, one case was across the road from our depot or station, whatever you want to call it, was a German concern that had engineers, German engineers in it. And it was guarded by a civilian type. They wore a uniform, and they had dogs and things like that. They weren't like our guard dogs or our sentry dogs. They were more of a shepherd. But not a German shepherd type. So a couple of our heroes, as I call them, got drunk one night and was going to go over there and hassle them. And they wound up creating quite a little incident for us and everybody involved because they were in an area they were trespassing. It wasn't a restricted area. It was some type of building equipment. And they were over there, and the guard caught them, and they were arrested by the German Polizei. And it's kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Again, they were court-martialed and sent out of the unit.
Mm-hmm. Were there a lot of court-martials in your unit?
There seemed... I was naive. I thought that the military police, there would never be any court-martials.
Mm-hmm.
But there were three or four special court-martials and two or three Article 15s.
Mm-hmm.
In about 9 months.
Okay.
The Article 15s, most of it was for going to sleep on duty. People get up in the tower and they just, boredom takes over and they just stand up in the corner and go to sleep.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else striking about your duty in Germany?
Not a bit.
Okay. What were the major things that you took away from that experience, especially as it related to what you would eventually experience in Vietnam?
I think the first thing it taught, one of the things that it taught me, and I stuck with me even today,
mm-hmm.
is know what's going on around you. Be aware of your surroundings. And anything that seems a little out of place, investigate immediately.
Were there specific, was there a specific or other specific examples of where you did that in Germany and it paid off? That was it was important.
Well, I don't know that was anything that ever paid off or not. But we had a lieutenant that used to try to sneak up on us on the towers,
mm-hmm.
and I heard stories about it. So one night he was coming up between the fence line, which he was authorized to,
mm-hmm.
and I called for him to halt, and he just looked at me, and I called for him to halt three times, and he didn't halt. So the third time I yelled and he didn't stop, I locked and loaded my M14. And I had his undivided attention.
Mm-hmm. What was his response when he heard you lock and load your M14?
He stopped immediately,
mm-hmm.
and he complied with my instructions.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never seen the man before. I knew who he was, but, you know, as far as meeting him or not, I hadn't.
Mm-hmm.
So when he was, part of the challenge was senior man, advance forward to be recognized. When he came forward, I didn't recognize him, and it was raining, so I put his face in the mud. And I did everything by the book, and he, from that day on, he had this strong dislike for me,
mm-hmm.
but he never messed with me.
Mm-hmm.
And that is another thing that I took away from, took with me for the rest of my career.
Mm-hmm.
If you're right, be damned of who they think they are. You're the boss.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, well, you went from Germany back, you went back from Germany to OCS at Fort Benning, Georgia.
Yes, sir.
And so what was, how long were you there? What was that training like? And what prompted you to leave?
I left because my TAC officer and I, my senior TAC,
mm-hmm.
a Lieutenant Dura Lackey, and I did not see eye to eye.
Mm-hmm.
I made a comment about, he said that he thought that I'd make a good TAC officer. And I told him I wasn't chicken such and such enough to be a TAC officer.
Mm-hmm.
And he took offense to that, and he asked if I was calling him chicken crap, and I said, well, sir, I guess if the shoe fits, we have to wear it. And I was just relieved from OCS for disrespect toward a superior officer.
Okay. How long were you there before this happened?
About 14 weeks.
How was the training up to that point?
Highly intensified, rapid, a lot of harassment involved, and a lot of it would come back and with a lot of benefits. I was introduced to the M14E2, which is a fully automatic rifle. I was introduced to an M60 machine gun that I'd only seen and fired one time before. I was introduced to the M16, the AK-47, the SKS, and other assorted weapons.
What did you think about the M16 when you first fired it?
When I first fired the M16, I thought, wow, a Super 22. No recoil, not a lot of noise, and fairly accurate.
What did you think of it compared to the fully automatic M14?
Well, I preferred the M14 because I seemed to shoot better with it. It was the M14 was heavier, and you couldn't carry as much ammunition. So there's trade-offs on it. I preferred the M14 over the M16 to start with.
And in terms of what you thought about the M16, if you needed it in a combat environment, were you concerned at all about the smallness of the round or anything like that?
I was concerned about the M16 on many things. One, it's got a composite stock and composite forearm. Not conducive for butt strokes. Put a bayonet on it, and you still got a fairly short weapon. If I'm going to have to use a bayonet, I kind of like to be a little ways from my work. I heard some nasty stories about it, and some of them were definitely true. I had malfunctions during my qualification phase with the M16.
And that complied with some of the rumors you had heard about the weapon?
Yeah, I was firing. I was going into the last phase of my qualification with the M16 when the bolt ripped the head off a cartridge. And I had a stuck cartridge in my chamber. I couldn't chamber another round. So I was boloed and had to start all over again.
How about other problems? Anything else with it, the M16?
Well, the training M16s, every now and then other people had a problem. It would fail to feed. The magazine wouldn't put another round up to be picked up. Once in a while they jammed. I don't know, it was due to bad ammunition or just sloppy cleaning. Since these were weapons that we picked up from a weapons pool, you know, I don't know who cleaned them before we got them. I imagine it was a group of trainees or people waiting for discharges. And, of course, that is not the type of individual that, shall I say, does the best work.
Okay. And what else was important about OCS as far as, you know, lessons that you learned, things that you were able to take away from that training that would be important for you later on?
one of the most important things I picked up in OCS was some infantry tactics, basic tactics that would come in very handy.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the most one of the things I learned was cooperate and listen to other people's ideas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was a real, shall I say, class in teamwork.
Mm-hmm. Now, just out of curiosity, and if you don't want to talk about this, that's fine. You had spent enough time in the military to know that by saying what you said to your senior TAC, the outcome would very much be like what it was. Was this intentional on your part? Did you just want out, or?
No, I didn't think he would do it.
You didn't think he'd push to have you removed?
No, I didn't.
Oh, okay.
Because there was other people that had did things a lot worse, and he kept them.
Hmm.
But I will say this, it was the biggest favor anybody ever did me.
You think so?
Oh, yes.
How so?
Well, if I had continued, I'd have went to MP basic officer,
mm-hmm.
and I would have been a platoon leader in 101st Airborne or 101st Air Mobile in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
If I had survived Vietnam the first time in the 70s, I'd have been rifted, and I'd have probably been thrown out of the Army. Because when they rifted officers that were OCS grads that went in as privates first class,
mm-hmm.
they didn't have the choice of staying.
Oh.
They were rifted back, and we don't need you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And you ended up staying in the military for how long?
Excuse me, sir, I didn't get that.
Oh, how long did you end up staying in the military?
I ended up staying in the military 20 years and some days.
Okay.
I retired.
So you made it a career. And you would not have been able to if you finished OCS. Interesting. Okay. Well, can you describe some of the worst things that some of the other OCS candidates had done that didn't result in their removal?
One had four violations of the honor code. He lied. He's never supposed to wear civilian clothes.
Mm-hmm.
He was in a swimming suit and left a place called Callaway Gardens. So he put on a T-shirt and a pair of shorts. Civilian clothes. He'd been drinking, and he was driving. He had an accident, and he was at fault. But the young lady that was with him said it was her car she was driving. And he let her take the fall for his, quote, military career.
Mm.
Another one threw a kitchen knife, flatware knife,
mm-hmm.
at the TAC officer one day and told him, get the hell out of my face.
Damn. He didn't get kicked out for that?
No.
Wow. Yeah, that's just a sight.
Of course, I think maybe his daddy being a full bird colonel may have had some insight on that.
Mm. Okay. Yeah, so those are some pretty serious infractions.
That's assault.
Well, yeah, with the second one.
An
arrestable offense.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, what you, let's see here, you left the Fort Benning, Georgia, went to the 1st MP Company.
See you in Vietnam.
In Vietnam, 66 to 67. Now, when did you find out that you were going to be going to Vietnam?
August the 20, I'm going to say the 24th or the 25th of August, 1966.
Mm-hmm. What did you think?
Well, the reason I got picked to go to Vietnam, I had doubts in the about the Army then.
Mm-hmm.
I went in, and I told this lady in assignments, I said, I'm supposed to be going to Bremerhaven, Germany, I believe. And she looked at me, and she said, you're a damn MP. You're going to Vietnam.
Okay.
And I said, excuse me. That wasn't a good phrase in those days, but
mm-hmm.
that's what I said.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, one of your damn white hats just give me a ticket. All MPs go to Vietnam. So I looked at her and I said, what will be, let's get it on.
Did you file a complaint?
With whom?
I don't know, she had to have a boss. I mean,
well, I had been in the military long enough to know then that civilians weren't God, but they talked to God.
Hmm.
And filing a complaint against a civilian in 1966 was a waste of pen and ink and paper.
Hmm. Okay. All right, so you're going to Vietnam. Did they give you some leave before you left? Or?
Yeah, they gave me 14 days.
Okay. What did your family think about you going to Vietnam?
Mixed emotions. My wife was scared. My
yeah.
mother was scared.
Yeah.
My stepdad said he thought it'd be a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
My dad said, oh, well, you got some survival skills. You'll make it.
Mm-hmm. Did your wife and your mother actually voice their fears
yes.
very much with you?
Yes, my mother did. My mother was not real well, and I was real concerned about her.
Yeah. How did your wife handle it?
Oh, she voiced her fears one time, and then after that, it was a taboo subject. We didn't talk about it anymore.
Yeah. How about your kids?
They were pretty young. They didn't quite understand. All they knew, Daddy was going someplace. They didn't know where.
Yeah. How old were they at the time?
Let's see. My oldest one would be about 6. My youngest one about 4.
Okay. What was the hardest part for you?
Getting on a plane. Leaving them at the airport to fly to California.
Mm-hmm. Well, you found yourself in Vietnam then in, let's see, it would have been, what month in 66 about?
October.
October 66. What was the first, what was your first experience? You know, what do you remember most about when that door opened?
The heat. I got a welcome to Vietnam that most people don't get. I was on a 707,
mm-hmm.
one that I probably helped build.
Okay.
And we were coming in for a landing. Gear was down, flaps and everything. And we just were ready to set her on the airport when all of a sudden the throttles went to the firewall and a 707 climbed out steeper than I thought it could climb.
Hmm.
We came from probably 40 feet off the ground, and we went to 10,000, just whew. And the pilot never said why. He did. We just went up, and we orbited Thompson Sanute for about 5 or 10 minutes. We came back, and he started down again. And somebody said, hey, we're going to set it down this time. And we landed. And a gentleman came on the plane, and he said that you're to carry your own baggage. You're not to give these Vietnamese any American money. You know, the usual threats.
Mm-hmm.
We opened up that. We got on the tarmac, and oh, my God, what have we got into? There's 100 degrees out there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the people looked a little different. They were. You know, there's all kind of yellow complected, and they were small.
Mm-hmm. Anything else that you remember from your first experience on the ground?
No, just everybody was trying to tell me they wanted to carry my bag, and I was scared to death to let anybody even touch my bag.
Okay. Well, so you found yourself at a replacement company at that point, or?
Yeah, the first replacement company is Xeon.
Okay. And how long did you have to stay there?
Well, I stayed there for 7 days, and it's kind of interesting because the first day I was there, well, now let me back up here a minute, sir. I went through Long Bend before I went to the first replacement company.
Okay.
When I got to Long Bend, they were just building Long Bend, and I had got processed in, and they were talking about all these great duties. You know, replacement companies are slave companies.
Mm-hmm.
They got unlimited supply of labor. And they was telling that so many people would be on KP, so many people would be on burning detail and guard. And something was said about a guy, I can't remember his name. His last name was Gadsden. Gadsden and I was in the replacement company at Fort Benning together. He was an OCS dropout, and he had been formerly in the 173rd Airborne Brigade. And somebody said something about Specialist Gadsden was the commander of the relief. And I went over and I asked the sergeant of the guard where Gadsden was at. He told me, so I went over, and Gadsden was asleep, and I woke him up by yelling at him, that he was on his way back to OCS, and he came awake, and he came up, and he said, "I'll be damned." So immediately, I was on the security force.
Mm-hmm.
That night, armed with an M14, two other guys and I were on patrol. We had somebody try to run the gate, and I fired my first shots in anger in Vietnam.
Did you actually hit anybody?
Yes, I did.
Wow.
We had, they were cowboys, and they had been coming in and stealing stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they were chasing the gate guards clear out of there because a lot of the gate guards, they didn't want to be in Vietnam. And these guys come out there and throw a string of firecrackers at them, and they were gone. Well, they threw the string of firecrackers, and this one was in the wire. And I can't remember if I shot three times and yelled halt or yelled halt three times and shot. All I know is I fired three times, and I had two of them laying in the wire.
Killed?
KIAs.
Wow. Did that help, I guess, send the message that that type of activity was no longer acceptable? Or?
It sure did for some people. Well, as I know, is after I did it, I was so sick for about 3 hours, I couldn't believe myself.
Mm-hmm. What were the things that went through your mind? Were these the first people you ever killed?
Yes. That's the first time I'd ever fired at anybody in anger.
Mm-hmm.
Or in duty.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's amazing. It was amazing that I hit. And because I was probably 200 yards away,
mm-hmm.
and I was just standing. I just jumped out of the truck and came into a standing position and fired.
Mm-hmm.
And I took two of the three out, and the other guys didn't even fire.
What happened to the third person trying to come in?
He left.
Okay.
Don't know if they hit him or not, but, of course, the sergeant of the guard, the officer of the guard, and everybody else was out there immediately,
mm-hmm.
took the M14 away from me. And I think one of the things that probably helped me a lot was one of these people had a grenade on him.
Oh, okay.
But the practice there before had been they would throw stuff at the gate guards. The gate guards would run,
mm-hmm.
and they'd come in and steal whatever they could because... Mm-hmm. At that time, Long Bend was not well guarded. They were still; they were just building it.
Mm-hmm. Now, what kind of instructions had you received in terms of the rules of engagement and things like that before you actually went on this patrol? Were you given a briefing?
I was given a briefing. I was just told anybody tried to come in through the gate, I was to stop.
Okay.
They didn't say how.
So they didn't talk about use of deadly force or, you know, anything like that?
That subject never came up. They said anybody tries to come through the gate or come through the fence are considered enemy and they are to be stopped.
Wow. What did the officer and the NCO in charge, what did they say to you? I take it you probably went through some kind of a debriefing.
I was immediately taken back to the guard shack,
mm-hmm.
and they started to say something. I said, "People, you're gonna have to excuse me because I am sick." And I went outside and I upchucked everything that I'd eaten in 2 days, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
And I come back in. There was an old master sergeant around there, and when I say old, I mean old. He gave me a canteen of water, and he said, "Go wash your mouth out, son." Wash my mouth out, and I come back, and he said, "Did you drink some of that?" And I said, "Yes, sir. Yes, Sergeant." And he took me to one side, and out of his side pocket, he pulled a little flask, and he gave me a shot of whiskey, and he said, "There you are." He said, "By God, you're a combat veteran now. Go talk to him." I went over, and they asked me to give them a statement.
Mm-hmm.
I'd give them a statement. I told them exactly what happened, what I had done. And the sergeant of the guard called the vehicle back in and put me back on it. And the officer of the day, or the officer of the guard, said, "Definitely put him back on there."
Now, did you, before you went and were questioned, did you go up to the fence and see the people that you had killed?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
First thing I did was went up to check to make sure, one, if I checked them both for signs of life.
Mm-hmm.
Also checked to see if they had weapons. I checked to see if they had weapons first,
mm-hmm.
and that's when I found the grenade in the guy's pocket.
Mm-hmm.
I took the grenade out, ensured that it was safe, and handed it to one of the other people and told him, "Go back over by the truck with this and just stay there."
Mm-hmm.
I then checked the pulse, and I couldn't feel the pulse. I then put my hand close to their face to see if they were breathing, and one of them sort of, I guess a twitch would be a good way to say it. I backed off, and the next time I went there, he was expired.
Mm-hmm. How did that affect you, knowing that that was... I mean, you acted as you had to act. You were a threat. You shot. What kinds of thoughts were going through your mind?
I was afraid I'd be court-martialed. You know, I'd heard rumors and whatnot, but, and then I got sick.
Mm-hmm.
My biggest fear that right then was I was going to be court-martialed for shooting these people.
Mm-hmm. And what about your the other soldiers that you worked with? What did they, did you talk to them at all? Did they ask any questions, or?
Not really, because, when the vehicle came back, there was a new driver and another two new people in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing one said was the driver said, "Oh, you're the new guy that just greased two of them. And I said, yes, I was forced to shoot two people tonight. And he said, I hear you're a damn good shot. And that was the end of the conversation. And then the next day, I went to the first replacement company.
Okay. And you were there at the first replacement company for a week.
Yeah, I was selected by an individual as an escort to the people going to Tonsonute to fly home.
Mm-hmm.
And it was what we called the run.
Mm.
We would take the people that were going home. We'd take them down to Tonsonute, and then we'd go to Long Bend and pick up replacements and bring them back.
Okay.
And since I had experience with an M60 machine gun and an M14, each morning I drew an M60 and put it in a pivot mount and right behind the cab of the deuce and a half. And then I had an M14 when we got into crowded areas where automatic fire would not be acceptable or prudent. I had an M14 for that.
Mm-hmm.
While I was there, one thing that was kind of strange, went down to Tonsonute and went up to Long Bend, and we picked up these officers. And, of course, I had a little briefing that I had to give them. If we have a problem, we get shot at, everybody down on the floor and just stay down until I give you the all clear. I'll do the shooting. And one of the lieutenants there was an engineer. And, of course, they didn't stay in a replacement company long. The next day after we escorted him back, he came down to the first replacement company with his battalion commander, and they wanted me assigned to the 1st Engineer Battalion as a battalion commander's driver. And I asked the lieutenant, I said, sir, why would you want me to do something like that? And he said, because you have a positive attitude, you act like you know what you're doing, and you're not afraid. And anyway, the commander of the replacement company nixed that idea and sent me to the 1st MP company.
Now, while you were at the 1st replacement company, did they give you any kind of in-country briefings, you know, what to expect, things to be careful of, what are certain Vietnamese customs and things like that?
The only thing they did is they told me that I was going to be the escort. I didn't get any briefing. They gave me the M60. They gave me an M14. It was a different one every day. And the second day I went out, I was checking the M14 that I was issued, and I discovered that part of it was missing.
What part?
There's a spring in there that the recoil operating spring. So I took it back, and never having been a meek and laid-back person, I'm pretty boisterous and very forward, I took it back, and I was going to whip the individual between this M14.
Mm-hmm.
And Sergeant told me he didn't think it'd be a good idea. And I said, I won't hurt him bad, I'll just hurt him. And so Sergeant said, no, here, you take the M14. So after that, any time I went and checked out a weapon, I could go behind the first replacement company, and there was a place there, and it was a free fire zone out there, and I could fire 5 rounds to make sure the weapons worked. As a matter of fact, that practice started then. Everybody that got a weapon and was on escort duty would go back and fire at least 5 rounds out of the weapon,
mm-hmm,
to make sure the weapons were combat functional.
Pretty prudent.
Yeah, especially if you'd have needed it without that recoil spring.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what was your reception like when you went to the first MP company?
First thing that happened when I got there was the usual hooting and hollering. And I was I was assigned to a tent. My platoon sergeant was a gentleman by the name of Lynn Holm. And they called him Rock. And he took me over to the tent and introduced me to a couple of E4s. And one of them, his name was Steiniger. Private Steiniger looked at me, and he said, "I used to be a sergeant." But he said, "I came here, and I'm a private, and I'm going home as a civilian." And he said, "They don't even make calendars as long as you got to do in this place." And it was just good-natured ribbing, and a couple of them took me to one side. A specialist Bond, who was a Korean veteran. Kind of interesting thing. His name was James Bond.
Okay.
And him and a young man by the name of Scott took me to one side. They told me a lot of things. They fed me a lot of BS, I'm sure. But they told me some things that I needed to know. And they definitely gave me some tips that later saved my life.
Do you recall anything in particular?
Bond told me, never, never just go out with a .45 and one magazine. Always carry three or four magazines.
Okay. Any other lessons?
Excuse me?
Any other lessons that they tried to impart on you?
Yeah, they told me that I would probably start out as a driver. We'd work a week on gates and a week on convoy. And when I was on convoy or patrol, if I was fired at and a Jeep would run, get the hell out of the area quickly. If I was a gunner and we were fired on, get behind the gun, return fire if I could see where it was coming from. They told me about, well, they reinforced some of my training from OCS. Observe smoke, and if you hear a bullet go over your head, count to hear the crack. You see the smoke, count to hear the crack of the weapon. Not to trust anybody. And to pay particular attention to people along the road or in fields when you went by, because some hoes and shovels were actually single-shot weapons.
And did that happen a lot, where people would just take pot shots at you?
Oh, yeah. When I first got there, we had a guy we called 4 O'Clock Charlie. And everybody's had a Charlie. Anyway, every afternoon about 4 o'clock, the east gate, excuse me, the west gate, or the south gate of Xenon, we get one or two rounds. And one afternoon, I checked out a sniper rifle. The armor and I was good friends, and they had a sniper rifle, why, I don't know. And I went out, and the south gate, and I made myself a pretty good rest on top of the bunker there. And the sergeant of the guard came out, and he said, "What are you going to do, Nelson?" And I said, "I'm tired of this guy shooting at us. I'm going to get him." And he said, "You know," he said, "I really admire your thought." But he said, "Just remember, he's never hit anybody yet, and his replacement might be a better shot." And I thought that was kind of odd. But then I got to thinking about it. You know, this guy, he's harassing us, but he never hit anybody. So we could take him in coming around now and then. So I didn't shoot him, but I think somebody got him with a helicopter at a later date because a helicopter came by one afternoon, and there's a shot fired, and they come around, and they had 460s on it, on the outboard riggers.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, they chewed up that area out there pretty good. We didn't have any more shots at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Was there ever a replacement?
Nope.
And he never did hit anybody?
No, not to the best of my knowledge. He never did hit anybody.
Mm-hmm.
He did hit the gate, the bunker at the gate, mm-hmm. occasionally.
Was it always just one shot that he'd fire, or would he fire a couple of shots?
Oh, once in a while it'd be two, but most of the time it was just one.
Hmm.
We always figured it was a homemade weapon. And
mm-hmm. What did you find yourself doing primarily? You put in your response on the questionnaire that a lot of convoy escort, patrol, and patrolling armed reaction riflemen. You were an M60 gunner and an investigator. What did you find yourself doing most on a day-to-day basis?
Well, the first 4 or 5 months I was there,
mm-hmm.
well, the first 2 months I was there, I was at Base Camp Zeon.
Mm-hmm.
And Base Camp Zeon, 1 week I would work gates. It'd be either nights or days. And then the next week would be patrol or convoy duty. And, you know, it was you never knew what you was going to do.
Mm-hmm.
We had 5 patrols that was called Alpha patrols. Alpha 3 was, you just patrolled Zeon.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember where the others were, but we patrolled the town of Zeon, out to the Zeon bypass, the Zeon strip. The other one went down to a place called Tuduk, and we patrolled that place looking for the usual stuff.
Mm-hmm.
AWOLs, drunks, people weren't supposed to be there. It was all off limits.
Mm-hmm.
We had another one went out to a place called Foo something. It was
Fuloy?
West of Zeon.
Was that Fuloy?
No, Fuloy was north of Zeon.
Okay.
This was west, this little town, Fook something.
Mm-hmm.
And they had an advisor group there and Australians.
Hmm.
And everybody in the 1st MP Company was armed with either, well, most of them were issued AM-14s. Some of them were just issued 45s. And it's very hard to control a M-14 in a Jeep. So I went out to the advisors at this Fook whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked them to the advisors about some things. And they gave me 3 pistols. I took the pistols back and did some horse trading with 701st Maintenance Company and got me an an M16.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a new one that just came out. It was made up for me. I got a regular M16 the group, you know, the magazine, the one part with a serial number on it.
Mm-hmm.
I got that out of a scrap pile that was serviceable.
Mm-hmm.
And the first one I got, I took it out to the advisory team, and the sergeant had it made into an M16, and the problem with it, there's a pin that wouldn't stay in, but he found out by putting green tape on it, it would work.
Mm-hmm.
So I went back and got me another action, and I took it out there, and they made what became known as a CAR 15. And so when I was on my patrol or on my convoys, I carried this CAR 15 because I could carry so much more ammunition, and I could control it in the Jeep.
Mm-hmm.
regulations said you were not supposed to have your own personal weapon. Well, we kind of overlooked that from time to time.
Mm-hmm. Did MPs, you or other MPs, like to carry weapons, smaller, more compact automatic weapons, like, say, the grease gun or anything like that?
Grease guns, Thompsons.
Mm-hmm.
Used to take an M2 carbine and saw it off right in front of the gas cylinder,
mm-hmm.
cut it off right at the back of kind of the pistol grip.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, somebody over there came back to the United States and started making them. They called them the Enforcers.
Mm.
They were used by law enforcement people in the mid-60s, early 70s.
Okay. Well, you said that you went over to this group of advisors. Were these military advisors, civilian advisors? Did you know?
They were U.S. advisors to a mobile unit. They had some things that called V-something 100s. They were kind of a big, tired, armored car.
Mm-hmm.
And they had twin 30-caliber machine guns and a turret.
Okay.
We're going to have to take a quick break here for a
minute. I was just going to say, we've been going an hour, so you want to take a pause?
Yeah, I'll be back with you in a second, sir.
Okay. What were the primary units in the base area around Xi'an, you know, as far as infantry units I take it was infantry units that were there with you?
Well, it was a support unit. There's first support battalion.
Uh-huh.
701st Maintenance,
uh-huh.
and Engineers.
Okay. So no infantry units?
Oh, we had infantry units around us, yes.
Okay. What were the biggest problems, and what were your primary responsibilities in terms of patrolling and policing? You know, as a military police officer working in Vietnam, what was your function?
Traffic control and apprehending people that violated regulations and laws, watching people that were, I hate to say, messed up, but yeah, we had drunks, we had people on drugs we had to apprehend.
Mm-hmm.
We had to pick up prisoners. We had to pick up prisoners of war. The MP company, to give you an idea of some size, had 9 platoons in it.
Wow.
We had our own mortar section that were all MPs.
Mm-hmm.
We had our own infantry platoon that were all MPs. Matter of fact, some of them went through AIT with me.
Mm-hmm.
We had our own guard and escort platoon that did nothing but handle the prisoners of war.
Mm-hmm.
We escorted people around. We provided information to people coming through the gate. Somebody come from some place and say, you know, we come through here and we're looking for the first replacement company, or can you tell us where we can get some food, or do you guys have a PX? Do you have a service club? Or things like that.
Mm-hmm. Now, were there a lot of, you mentioned one of the things that you guys had to do as far as apprehending soldiers who had problems either with alcohol or with drugs. Was that something prevalent when you were there, drug use? And if so, what drugs?
There was drug use. I don't know how prevalent it was, but the drugs that I was aware of on my first tour in the MP company was mostly marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some big-time dealers.
Mm-hmm.
They'd buy a refrigerator and take all the insulation out of it, fill with marijuana, try to send home.
Wow.
Another thing was they'd buy these dolls, fill them with marijuana, and try to send them home.
Now, how did you detect these? Like the refrigerators, the dolls? Did you have dogs? That were snipers,
they were detected by customs people.
Oh, okay.
And they would send us a undeveloped lead, and we'd go back after them.
Okay.
Another thing that we had to do later when I became an investigator mm-hmm. was watch for the black marketing of money.
Hmm. American currency?
Oh, yes.
How did that work? How did they filter black American dollars through the black market?
Well, the dollar MPC rate of exchange on Bays, I think, was about 100 piastres to the dollar.
Okay.
For the MPC, that was the going exchange on post.
Mm-hmm.
A greenback off post could get you 2,000 to 3,000 piastres.
Wow.
Oh, yes.
And that was against Army regulations?
Oh, yes. You wasn't even supposed to have greenbacks in Vietnam. But there's ways around that.
Why was that? Do you know?
Excuse me?
Why was that? Why were soldiers not allowed to have greenbacks in Vietnam?
Because of the black marketing of it.
Okay.
We were paid in military payment certificates, MPC.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was illegal to give that to the Vietnamese even.
Hmm. Okay. So did you actually have to arrest people that were engaged in this activity?
Oh, yeah, several times.
Wow.
One of the ways that they would get it was, let's say that you was in a unit that and you're ready to go home.
Mm-hmm.
You're derosing. Well, if I'm somebody like the first sergeant or a squad leader or a platoon sergeant or a company commander, and I have got all this MPC that I can't really account for how I got it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to keep it. I don't want to throw it away. And you're going home and you've got maybe $20 to your name. I'll come up and said, look, I'll give you $350 in MPC. You cash it in, and then you give me $300 back, and you keep the $50. So when you get up, just before you get ready to get on your aircraft, you go up there and you cash your MPC in for greenbacks. And then, of course, you turn around and you say goodbye to your whoever it is there, or his driver, whoever brought you up there,
mm-hmm.
and you give him the money, and they take it back, and then they do things like put it in film canisters and send it home, or just put it in an envelope and two or three 20s in around three sheets of paper, and send it home.
What was the highest ranking person that you recall that was found and arrested for that activity?
A lieutenant colonel.
Wow. And what other major problems, law enforcement problems, did you encounter as an MP in the first MP company?
Drunks.
Was this something that was prevalent amongst support personnel as well as the ground combat units? Or?
Well, we had a thing called Division Forward, which I was also part of.
Mm-hmm.
And at one time, after a couple months at base camp, and we went out and we were out for, depended 2 months, 3 months. You come back in and you get all your pay. And the first thing they did was head down to see how much of that booze I could drink.
Mm-hmm.
And, I always felt, there's a guy that's been out in the field for 3 months. He came back, he got drunk. He's not a bad drunk. Take him down, turn him over to somebody with some authority, and say, put him to bed and tell him to shut up. You know, if we want to go that way, that's fine. I don't know how many times on the evening patrol I've hauled drunks back to their unit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they used to call me the taxi. Well, that's okay. These guys might get shot tomorrow. What the hell? They're a little bit drunk tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Why bust their chops?
Mm-hmm.
But now if they got stupid, then it's all over.
Mm-hmm.
You want to fight me, you want to get dumb, you want to pull a knife, you want to pull a gun, we go through the paperwork drill.
Mm-hmm.
We had a lot of vehicles that questionable operators. The Jeep, you know, doesn't have a key or anything. It's just got a switch on it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they took and welded a chain on the Jeep and put a padlock on it. And you padlock the steering wheel. The problem with that is you could take and break that little bar on the seat and you had your Jeep.
Mm-hmm.
A little hard to steer, that chain whipping around, but you could do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I busted a guy one night. He was drunk. He was outside the Red Cross compound. And he was yelling at the top of his lungs to a young lady in there, professing his love to her.
Mm-hmm.
And she wasn't interested. She called the EMTs. And, of course, I went down, and he was drunk. He was had a fifth of whiskey and a case of beer in his Jeep, and he also had a pound of marijuana. Just wasn't his night.
Mm-mm. Now, you mentioned before that sometimes they would get dumb and, you know, pull a knife or a gun even. Did that happen very often, or...?
Yeah, probably once a week.
Hmm. Okay.
One guy pulled him on the NCO club, and while I'm trying to talk him out of the knife, one of the bartenders just reached over the bar with a bottle, laid him out with it.
Now, when something like that happens, does the bartender get charged as well? Or?
Nope.
Okay.
I didn't see who did it.
Okay.
And nobody would tell me.
Okay.
I didn't really try to find out.
Yeah. And you mentioned POW processing. Now, on the MP side of that, did that involve interrogation at all, or was it just actually physically holding and processing POWs that had come back from the front?
We never interrogated any POWs. We had a compound within our MP compound.
Mm-hmm.
That was there. We'd take them down there. We had one for men, one for women. And we just put them in there and we guarded them.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody came down to interrogate them, one of us was always around to ensure that they didn't use those tactics like the telephone and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Never had to worry about it. The first military intelligence company were professionals. They wouldn't do something that dumb.
Mm-hmm. Did you work closely with them, with the military intelligence people?
When I was a military police investigator, I did.
What kinds of work did you do with them as an investigator?
Excuse me. Mine was mostly information that I would develop from my informants. We'll say that one guy is trying to slip arms and ammunition off post to his friends that are Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
They would give me tips about people that were AWOL and things like that.
Okay. You say informants. Are you talking about Americans, Vietnamese, or both?
All the above.
Did you work much with Vietnamese people?
As in the first MP company, when I worked on post,
mm-hmm.
as a the Alpha 3,
mm-hmm.
we had a Vietnamese national policeman assigned to us.
Oh, okay. How did you get along with him?
That depends on the national policeman. Some I got along fine with.
Mm-hmm.
I had one time that I felt like kind of a funny story. We were a traffic control point, and his name was Jung. And Jung was noted to be pretty heavy-handed with the kids. You'd go to set up a traffic control point, and you'd have 50 kids around you. You know, shine your shoes, GI, you give me a cigarette. I buy you beer. You know, they want to sell you their sister, their home.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, this Jung, he was kind of a bad dude at times. So one time we were setting up a traffic control point, and it was hot, and I drank a lot of water. And there's supposed to be two MPs, but there wasn't. They're just Jung and I, and it was out there. And I told him, I said, you stay here at the Jeep. I got to go over here and make a latrine call. So I went over to relieve myself, and when I came back, he said he was going out to relieve himself, and he walked out in the wood, out in the rubber tree plantation, and he wasn't probably 30 feet out in the rubber trees. And all of a sudden, I heard a grenade go off. I grabbed the M60 and ran out there, and there's Jung. He's bleeding from the mouth, bleeding from the ears. He's got this wild look in his eye. And all I see is kids running everywhere. So I grab Jung, made it back to Jeep, call for reinforcements and a medevac. And Jung was excited, and he was speaking Vietnamese faster than I could understand him. So when the medevac got there, they had an interpreter. What happened, Jung had been out there, and he threw a concussion grenade at some kids. But what happened, the grenade hit a tree and bounced back and went off about 15 feet from him. Never did see him again.
Any other incidents where people were injured or killed?
Yeah, Christmas Day, 1966, we were supposed to be having a ceasefire.
Mm-hmm.
And went down to the orphanage, and we brought two truckloads of Vietnamese kids out, and they were going to have Christmas dinner with the troops and everything. Bob Hope was going to be there. Bob Hope was there.
Mm-hmm.
And things like that. And I was the rear security. I was a gunner,
mm-hmm.
and so we weren't supposed to show any aggressive action. So by aggressive action, you tie the 60 down, and there's a strap for that. It's a real quick dismount. And if you need it, you just slide out of the seat, back up behind the 60. You don't stand behind the 60 or anything.
Mm-hmm.
We went down to the town of Zion. We came back. And right at the crossroad of the Zion Bypass, the road to Zion and Base Camp Zion, as the first unit went by, there was a round fired. And the leader of the convoy was a sergeant in the MPs. I can't remember his name. And he said, "Sniper, in the woods to the north." We just got on the road. I reached back and got a hold of the M60 to pull myself up. The second round went through the radio in the back of the Jeep. Part of the bullet caught me in the arm, and the driver swerved, and I was flipped out of the Jeep at about 25 miles an hour.
Mm.
I rolled off the road and into the bar pit. And I looked up, and all I could see was dust of the vehicles headed for the gate. While I'm trying to make myself invisible along the berm, the sniper fired again. He fired a total of 17 rounds. I fired a total of 22. I was hit in the arm. I have pieces of rock where he got pretty close that penetrated my skin. Mm-hmm. My .45 made contact with him twice, once in the left shoulder, once just above the navel.
Now, how far away was he from you?
About 60 yards.
Wow.
Had I only had one magazine, it wouldn't have, could have been a different story.
Mm-hmm.
When I fired when I heard the second shot, the second round that I heard hit, a rifle fell out of the tree. And when there's no more shooting, I went over and he was just hanging there. So I reached up and pulled him down. And he had expired, not knowing a lot about it, but I believe I probably hit his femoral artery.
Mm.
Or the aorta below the, you know, down in the stomach cavity there someplace.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I used my good arm to pull him over to the road, and I captured the weapon, of course. It was an AK-47 with a folding stock, the first one I'd ever seen like that.
Mm-hmm.
He had on a tan pith helmet that had a red star on it, and he had on a canvas belt that had a buckle with a red star. I pulled him back to the road, and I can remember parts of that, and I can and some things that aren't there, but I do remember that I had a headache so bad that my eyes ached.
Hmm.
I had blood on my arm. I had blood on my legs. I had blood on my mouth, my ears. And I looked up the road, and I seen two columns coming out. And there's a gun jeep in front and two gun jeeps in the column. I recognized them as MPs, and I got scared then that they were going to shoot me.
Mm-hmm.
I waited till I got close, and I held up my helmet as high as I could with both hands above my head. The first sergeant came up, and he said, "You're the livest corpse I've ever seen." I looked at him, and I said, put a cigarette in my mouth. I said, "Top, have you got a light?" And he said, "You're supposed to be dead." And I said, sorry to disappoint you. And about that time, my platoon sergeant came up, and he said, "Here, let me help you." And I don't know how he helped me, because when I woke up, I was in the hospital.
Well.
I was in the hospital for 2 days. And when I got out, my partner that had went back and told him I was dead, I'd been shot and knocked out of the jeep, was no place to be found.
Did you ever hear about what happened to him?
Strange thing. I found out 6 years later that he was sent to a place called Bamituit.
Okay. Did he survive?
Oh, yeah. He now lives in Kansas City, Missouri. I've never stopped by to see him. One of these days when I'm back that way, I'm going to call him up and ask if he'd like to have a beer and talk about old times.
Mm-hmm.
I think he'll probably decline.
Yeah. Well, what else happened while you were with the 1st MP Company? What are the major activities? You mentioned in your questionnaire that you were, I guess after the fact, you realized that you were part of Junction City.
Oh, yeah, we were part of Junction City, Operation Drake, Operation Mallard.
Mm-hmm. What was your role in those types of operations?
Security for the Commo installation.
Okay. Were there ever incidents of attempts at infiltrating by the Viet Cong?
Well, once in a while we'd get a stray running in and out of the compound at Lai K or Mentown, but nothing spectacular, you know. And I don't know if they were really VC or just Vietnamese looking for something to pilferage.
And did you have a lot of interaction with civilian Vietnamese?
Not during my first tour, no.
What did you think of the Vietnamese people?
My first tour, I didn't have a lot of thought about them. I thought they were all, 90% of them were VC, and I didn't understand them. I didn't understand their problems. I got along with them. I wasn't outwardly aggressive. You know, I didn't think, now can I shoot one and get away with it or anything like that, but I just didn't have a lot of interaction with most of them. Had a lot of interaction with police force and officials, but as far as an individual, not a lot.
Now, well, based on your experiences and based on your what you heard in your unit, what did you think the United States was trying to accomplish in Vietnam?
Well, at that time I was kind of naive. I thought that we were trying to accomplish pushing the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong out, setting up a free government to run by the Vietnamese people.
Do you think that the tactics fit that particular strategy?
Some of them did, some of them didn't. We had what was known as search and destroy, and it was a real estate swap. We'd take the hill today, and after we fought to take the hill, we'd come back to base camp, drink beer while Charlie moved back in.
What did you think of those particular operations, search and destroy missions?
Well, during the search and destroy operations, what people don't realize is when we went out and searched and destroyed some things, we tried to get people to come into villages and build what we call strong points. However, we took medics out with us, and we had sick calls. We had dentists out there. Mm-hmm. We improved the average Vietnamese life, I'm sure. You know, the people that were influential in Vietnam, they had access to doctors and dentists. The people who were less affluent, they didn't have this access to the doctors and the dental and some of the other things. The doctors, most of them, used herbal medicine, and I hate to say it, but almost like witch doctor treatment, some of them.
And so part of what you did was support civic action.
I was there on a lot. They were first called Lom Som operations. Mm-hmm. And we did a lot of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you left your first tour was 66 to 67. You left, came back to the United States, went to Aberdeen. Now, what did you think about your experiences upon leaving? You know, when you left Vietnam, what did you think in terms of, did you feel like you had accomplished anything? Did you feel like you had learned anything?
I guess I was overwhelmed. I learned a lot. I had viewed another country that, like most people, never has a chance to, you know, like a developing country, and seeing things that have been done. And I took a lot of pictures, and I thought, you know, I really did something this time, and I really felt I did. I didn't particularly ever want to go back. I learned a lot of lessons. And one thing that I did do, it made a gave me a real strong belief in a superior being.
While you were in country the first year, did you correspond a lot with your wife?
I wrote a letter every night.
Did you receive a lot of letters in return? Or?
I received a letter probably... Well, I didn't receive them on a timely basis, but yeah, the mail sometimes was a little slow getting through, and sometimes I wouldn't get any mail for a week, maybe a week and a half,
mm-hmm.
and then I'd probably get three or four letters. I got letters from my family. I got letters from my friends.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting way, I found out I was in Operation Junction City. Was a Democratic senator from Washington State, wrote me a little note, and he said his name was Martin Durkee,
mm-hmm.
and I'd met him one time, a long time ago, and we corresponded throughout the years,
mm-hmm.
and he wrote me a letter and said, I'm so proud of you on Operation Junction City. I thought, what the hell is he talking about? So I talked to one of the colonels that came into the commo thing. He's a pretty cool dude. He came in there one the commo area and said, "No, so you got any coffee?" Always got coffee, sir. Had a little kerosene stove and so poured him a cup. And I said, "Sir, can you tell me something?" He said, "Yeah." And I said, "What's the name of this operation we're on?" He said, "Shh, it's Junction City." And I said, "Well, a senator in Washington State already told me that."
So, keep it to yourself.
Yeah.
Well.
But about letters, I wrote, like I said, I wrote a letter every night.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the letters was, you know,
mm-hmm.
nothing real exciting happened today, but I want you to know I'm okay.
Yeah. Did you find that that helped a lot, writing and receiving letters?
Yeah, it really did. And I found out another thing. We had a lot of support there from older people.
Mm.
There were some people in Ohio, I believe it was, that sent a letter to the USO for any soldier. And they told us how they thought we were great people and all that. So I sat down and wrote them a short note. And they wrote me a couple more letters. And one time they asked me if I smoked. And I said, "Yeah, I smoke Pall Mall." So about a month later, I get this package in the mail. I had four cartons of Pall Mall cigarettes.
Wow.
There was a young lady in Georgia that used to write to me weekly that was her class project. She was in the third grade.
Hmm.
And I'm trying to think of some others. We got letters, a lot of the people, a lot of the GIs would never take the time to participate in something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd go and it's the USO guy would say, "Hey, you think you could look through one of these letters and talk to some of these people?" And I always had time to write a letter and talk to somebody.
Okay. Now, you mentioned earlier that you left Vietnam with a stronger sense that there was a higher being. Can you elaborate on that? In what way did you feel more strongly in your spiritual convictions?
I always had a saying, God protected fools and soldiers. I should have been dead on the Zion Bypass Christmas Day. January 26, 1966, I should have been dead when they shot the tires out from under the out of the Jeep, and we hit the ditch, and I rolled out over the top of the Jeep,
mm-hmm.
over the top of the hood, and down on the road, and picked up fragments of my legs. I mean, I was a couldn't move out there for a minute. I was a target.
Mm-hmm.
And bullets all around me, but nothing hit me.
Mm-hmm.
And in February, when the armored personnel carrier blew up, when I was within 20 feet of it, I should have been killed. The only thing it did was, I think it contributed to my hearing loss. It put shrapnel in me, and I survived.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody had to be looking out for me. If it hadn't been, there were 14 people. There were 13 people in the armored personnel carrier. Shows you 13 is an unlucky number. And myself. And the driver and I was the only two that survived. And the driver was discharged because he was stone deaf after the explosion.
What was the cause of the explosion?
A B-40 rocket.
And you and he survived, and everybody else was killed.
Yeah, it hit in, it hit through the side of the armed personnel carrier, and it just like a torch in there. I don't know what it hit, how it hit, and it just it popped him right out the driver's hatch. Just poof.
And how did you survive it?
I don't know. God, I guess. That's what I always said it was. Yeah, I was outside.
Mm-hmm.
It knocked me down. It actually pushed me down the road.
Mm-hmm.
I was medevaced. They pulled gravel out of my face, out of my legs. I had pieces of shrapnel on my back. And the only thing I can think is God was looking out for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else you want to add about your first tour?
Yeah, I think that I was, one, very lucky, and two, I must have made a real good impression because I went over a PFC and I came back a buck sergeant.
Wow. Okay. When you got back, you found yourself, let's see, where did you come in through as far as you left Vietnam, you came to the United States, you landed in the at Oakland Terminal or?
San Francisco.
Oh, San Francisco. Okay. How were you greeted there?
Well, there's a few hecklers.
Okay.
And one of the young ladies yelled and said, "Baby killers!" And I turned and looked her right in the eye and in a very low voice said, "Too bad that somebody didn't do that to you. You wouldn't be here to bother me today, would you?" And there must have been a look or something. She left. From San Francisco, we went to the Oakland Army Terminal. We were fed a steak dinner. Given a recruiting command lecture.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody here want to re-up right now?
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody here want to be a recruiter? Fitted for a new uniform and give 30 days leave.
Mm-hmm. And you found yourself after that, Aberdeen, Maryland.
Aberdeen Proving Ground, Maryland.
Standard MP duties there? Or?
Yep, white hat duty and... kind of an interesting thing, a sergeant from my unit in the 1st MP Company by the name of Wally Hicks was in charge of traffic there.
Hmm. Anything interesting happen while you were at Aberdeen?
Nope. Just we were sort of a replacement
mm-hmm.
center.
Mm-hmm.
First time I realized how bad things were in the States... I was a squad leader, and I had a platoon sergeant. We had a platoon ours was an E6. We had two E5s, and our platoon consisted of 10 people.
Mm-hmm.
Platoon should be 28 to 32.
Mm-hmm.
We had 10 people, mm-hmm. counting the two sergeants.
So seriously under strength.
Very much under strength.
Was that primarily because of the drain that Vietnam caused?
Yes.
Yeah. Did you ever find, was your unit ever activated to deal with any kind of demonstrations or problems with student activists or anything like that?
We had a contingency plan. We closed the post a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
And during the riots in Baltimore, we took items from Aberdeen to the Baltimore police.
Mm-hmm.
Flak vests, steel pots, 36-inch white oak batons.
Okay. But you yourselves didn't have to actually engage any kind of riot control or anything like that?
Nope.
Okay. And then you went from Maryland back to Germany.
Yep. A Company, 385th MP Battalion.
Mm-hmm. From 68 to 70, was that pretty much a similar duty to your previous experience in Germany? Or?
Nope. When I first got there, I was at Schwäbisch Gmünd as the NCOIC of the Schwäbisch Gmünd Detachment.
I'm sorry, would you spell that for me?
I can't spell Schwäbisch Gmünd, sir.
Oh, okay.
But I think it's SCH. EWABISH, I think.
Uh-huh.
Gmünd is GMEND.
Okay.
My company was at Kornwestheim between Ludwigsburg and Stuttgart,
mm-hmm.
at a place called Wilkins Barracks.
Mm-hmm.
My platoon leader was at Gerpingen, Germany, and my platoon sergeant was at Schwäbisch Gmünd. At Schwäbisch Gmünd and Gerpingen, we had an NCOIC. I was the one in Schwäbisch Gmünd, and a Sergeant Webb was the one at Gerpingen.
Okay. And what were your primary duties there?
My primary duties were patrol supervisor, desk sergeant, and ensuring that the detachment was run militarily with, and, you know, housekeeping and
mm-hmm.
classes and things like that.
Okay. Were there any additional problems or potential threats that you had to deal with in your second tour in Germany as far as, you know, threats from communist East Germany or Russia or anything like that, or Soviet Union or anything like that?
Not while I was at Schwäbisch Gmünd. I was promoted. I got there in October, and in January I was promoted to Staff Sergeant D6, 4 years, 8 days in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And I was taken from Schwäbisch Gmünd to Wilkins Barracks, where I was made the Headquarters Platoon Sergeant, the CBR NCO, and the Communications NCO. We didn't have the NCOs for communication, so I was it.
Okay.
There we were, let's see, one time we were on alert to go to Lebanon to remove American civilians.
Mm-hmm.
And we went as far as the Rhine Air Force Base and stayed there on alert for 2 days. Another time we were on alert for a demonstration in Frankfurt, and we were kept in reserve in case they overwhelmed the German police,
mm-hmm.
which they never did.
Mm-hmm.
There were a couple marches, and they threw rocks and whatnot. We were out of sight, but we were armed and ready to go.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you work a lot with the German Polizei? Or?
Not a whole lot. Mm-hmm. A case now and then, and mm-hmm. We knew them, and
mm-hmm.
We worked with the German military police, the field jägers. And we competed in a competition with the German military police, the English military police, and the Canadian military police. The demonstration we put on was more infantry than MP because the platoon sergeant for this project was an ex-Special Forces man. And all the squad leaders had Vietnam experience, so we sort of, shall we say, stacked the deck on them.
Mm-hmm. And so the Americans fared well in that competition.
Oh, yes, very well. Our demonstration was so outstanding. The colonel of the English contingency came over and said, "I say, old chops, you sure you won't come back as a colony? We could use you."
Okay. Were there other country forces in Germany with you besides the Canadians and the Brits?
There was French there, but I never had much contact with them at this time.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what did you take away from, well, I guess both your time at Aberdeen and your time in Germany? You know, what were the most important things you took away, especially as it relates to going back to Vietnam?
Nothing, actually.
Nothing?
Complacency could have got me in trouble.
Hmm. Okay. So you went back to Vietnam in 1970.
Yes.
In a civil affairs company capacity. MACV team number 15 in Hoi An.
I was assigned to the 29th Civil Affairs Company at Camp Horn, Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
with duty assignment to 2nd Platoon, Hoi An, MACV team 15.
Okay. What were your primary duties there?
I was an advisor to the correctional and detention centers of Quang Nam province.
Okay. Now, did you volunteer to go back to Vietnam, or was it something that was forced upon you?
I never volunteered for anything in the Army, sir.
Oh, okay.
It was sort of a mutual agreement. I couldn't get promoted in Germany because, I'd been in the Army less than 5 years,
mm-hmm.
or just 5 years. I just made E6, and I hadn't been there.
Mm-hmm.
And my first sergeant said that he couldn't force a waiver like that.
Mm-hmm.
The battalion sergeant major told me that I was being shortchanged because the waivers could be done if they wanted to do them. But I think that my first sergeant was, I don't want to say envious, but maybe feared me,
mm-hmm.
because I was in E6, and during the Christmas time of 1968, he was sick. He had a profile. He had a lot of profiles.
Mm-hmm.
And on holidays, he always had these problems. And so I was a senior E6 in the company, and I was first sergeant during the Christmas holidays of 68-69.
Hmm.
And I had a reputation that if you want something done, give me the assignment. It got done.
Mm-hmm.
My first assignment at Cornwestheim after I made E6 and came back was to refurbish the gym for a brigade basketball tournament.
Mm-hmm.
And the sergeant major said, "I don't know where I'm going to get the bodies," but he said, "I'll give you what I can." I was lucky. There was 48 new recruits came in, and they were all assigned to me for the first week they were in Germany. And I worked them from 7 o'clock in the morning till midnight every night.
Wow.
I refurbished the gym. We had the floor resanded and polished. The bleachers were fixed. There was 117 broken windows replaced. And then to top it off, I formed my own color guard and was the NCOIC of the color guard.
Mm-hmm.
And when they presented the awards, I was called up and given an award, and it was a colonel by the name of Holt, a real gentleman. He looked at my uniform and he said, "Sergeant," he said, "I'm going to have to talk to you about your decorations." He said, "You don't have them all on your uniform." I looked him in the eye and I said, "Which one don't I have, sir?" He said, "Well, your good conduct medal doesn't have any clasp in it." And he said, "You've only got one hash mark." I said, "Sir, that's all I'm authorized, like I told you when you promoted me. I only had 4 years and 6 days in the Army then." He looked at the sergeant major, and he told him, he said, "Sergeant major, you better watch this man. He'll have your job."
Mm-hmm.
And the first sergeant, I think, took note of that. Anyway, there's something about somebody. They had to furnish somebody a name for a possible exchange on a roster to go to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And the first sergeant said, "Would you feel bad if your name was on that?" I said, "Well, I wouldn't feel good because I've had one tour." And he said, "But you wouldn't really feel bad." And I said, "Well, I don't know." So maybe I kind of volunteered, but not, you know, not here, take me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, going in that at that time period, 70 to 71, I'm sure you are aware that as far as for the American side of things, we were trying to wind things down. A Vietnamization was in place. How aware were you of those issues?
I was very much aware of the Vietnamization of the plan.
Mm-hmm.
As an advisor, the only thing I was to do was to assist.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem previously to that, I understand, was it depended on where you was at and who was the advisor. Some advisors gave their counterparts everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a counterpart come up and say, "I need three sheets of tin for an advisor." "Yeah, no problem. You go get them."
Mm-hmm.
Another type of advisor was, "Yeah, you need three pieces of tin. I need $3 million. Good luck."
Okay.
My attitude and my philosophy was, you work as hard as you can, as long as you can on your side. If you don't get it, then I will assist through the American side. You know, I wasn't giving them anything.
Mm-hmm.
Don't give them a hand out, give them a hand up.
Mm-hmm.
And I helped them coordinate a lot of things, like one of the things the correctional center had was a well that, well, frankly, if it was in the United States today, whoever in charge would be in the jail, and all the inmates would be suing because the well was, the water was used right around the well. That's where they took their bath at. And it was no place for runoff. It was just right back into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the hooches didn't have tin on them. You know, they had the joists there, but they didn't have the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And things like that. The detention center, they cooked at their meals in two big pots down in this place that was infested with flies, rats, and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the first things I did was tell my counterpart at the detention center that, you know, we need to upgrade that. And it's kind of a strange thing. Both of my counterparts' name was Lou, spelled L-U-U. The man at the detention center, elderly gentleman, fought during World War II with the French. I remember the Japanese occupation.
Mm-hmm.
He was a member of the Gendarmeries, the French military police type thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in charge of the detention center. He spoke fair English, and the only thing he could think of was to make himself look good in my eyes, I think. Because if I'd make a suggestion, he'd start working on it. And if he couldn't get it finished, he'd come over and, "I beg your pardon, but I need to talk to you." We had a lot of people that were in the detention and the correction center that were craftsmen, and they were just sitting around. And my suggestion to them was, "Well, why don't we use these people to do things?" And like what? And I said, "Well, have them to, you know, they clean up a little bit, but have them to clean up, have them to build." "Well, we can't do that." And my question was, "Why can't we do it?" And they said, "Because it's never been done." So one of my projects was getting a real kitchen built. So I went and talked to Lou, and I told him, I said, I think we can get the concrete, because RMK dumps concrete every week, or every day, that they were building a humongous site out there at Hoi An. And sometimes they'd dump a half a yard of concrete, sometimes a yard. My first project had been to cement around the well at the correction center. And the chief out there, his name was Lou, and he was a young guy, and he didn't like to do, you know, he liked to think about things a little while. So our first bucket load of cement we lost. But the second one we brought down, and we poured a floor in what was going to be the kitchen of the detention center. And I found out we had a couple of people that had worked with cement, or claimed they had, in the detention center. And they put a floor in, they put a drain in. I mean, they did an outstanding job. And we thought, now we'll just go up a ways with the walls being cement. And I wasn't much of an engineer. But, you know, what is it to making a form? You take some plywood and put some 2x4s behind it, you pour cement in between it, right? No, that's not the way you do it. Because when you do, that plywood will bow at the bottom. So the walls are supposed to be 2 inches of concrete, about 4 feet high. Excuse me. The walls at the base were a foot and a half thick, 2 feet, and at the top about 2 inches. Excuse me. I worked a deal with RMK where we could go out and sort their blocks for them. And the detention center and the correction center would take all the bad blocks, stack the good blocks on the pallets. So it helped us both. We built a kitchen, and the Marines gave me screen and things, and we made a professional kitchen out of it. We finally covered two-thirds of the correctional center with concrete on the ground.
Would you like to take a break to get...
The criminals.
Okay. So all of them. Okay. Now, the your principal role was to help advise and I guess, make this a better prison, upgrade the, like you said, the kitchen and things of that nature. Do you think that your recommendations were pretty much taken to heart by your Vietnamese counterparts consistently, or...
With Lou at the detention center, if I made a suggestion, it might as well have been written in stone.
Okay.
With Lou at the correction center, he had to discuss it. He attended school, he attended some type of school in Philadelphia. And he was more of, let's talk about this.
Okay. What did you think about the Vietnamese that you were working with, generally, as in terms of, you know, did you think that they were doing a good job or adequate?
All the Vietnamese I worked with in as an advisor
mm-hmm.
were outstanding citizens.
Mm-hmm.
They were great people. They did a good job.
Mm-hmm.
They were some of them were a little slower than I. They weren't as aggressive as I were.
Mm-hmm.
I am
mm-hmm.
on getting things done.
Okay,
but they are just they were. I would enjoy having them about around me today, even.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and you. What other Americans did you work with during that this time period? Were there a lot of other advisors, American advisors, that were working with you, or were you kind of alone out there?
I was alone in my department.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for the public safety. My boss was Mr. Jack Nelson, who lives across town from me right now, 70-some
mm-hmm.
years old. Staff Sergeant Martinez, another Arizona resident, that he was sort of a office manager for us. He took care of paperwork and track things and kept track of projects and made briefings and things like that. Sergeant First Class Jane Mills was the National Police Field Forces advisor.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the three of us in the public safety office.
Okay.
Sergeant Martinez and I was assigned to 29th Civil Affairs. Sergeant Mills was assigned to to MACV Team 15. I had a platoon leader and two or three other platoon members from the 2nd Platoon in Hoi An. We had advisors down to district level from the 29th. The platoon leader was a captain, and he had a driver that was a medic. And the medic and I, he was a private. We got promoted up to Spec 4 rather rapidly. And he told me one time that he was really concerned because he wanted to be a medic. And so I sort of got a wheel rolling in my head. And I went to Mr. Nelson. I said, how about we have a medic come out and hold sick call at the correctional center a couple times a week?
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Nelson looked at me like, you need to change your brand of cigarettes. And he said, well, it won't work. I said, why? And he said, well, I just don't think it'll work. He said, try it. He gave me a lot of latitude, a lot of, you know,
mm-hmm.
do it. Tell me what the results are. So I went and talked to the captain, and the first time I talked to him, he was lukewarm. So then my colonel came down, a colonel by the name of Gagger, a lieutenant colonel, fine gentleman. And Colonel Gagger and I had quite a discussion over a cup of coffee. And he told me, he said, well, he said, I'll support it. But he said, I don't want anything bad to happen. And I said, well, sir, I don't know what could happen, but we'll give it a try. My hardest sell was Lou. I finally convinced Lou we should do it. And we did. And Specialist McConnell came to the correction center under my direction and my personal escort. Every Tuesday and Thursday morning from 8 till 10 o'clock, he would hold a sick call.
Mm-hmm.
About 2 months into the program, we got a doctor who allegedly was from North Vietnam. And he seemed to be a pretty good doctor. He spoke fair English. And he was complaining that the American shouldn't be treating the Vietnamese. Vietnamese should be treating the Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him if he would work with Specialist McConnell. And he didn't think that was a good idea, and then he thought about it, and then Lou and him talked about it, and then Lou and I talked, and we agreed. And McConnell helped him until he rotated from, McConnell rotated out. He worked 2 days a week, sometimes three, at the correctional center with the North Vietnamese doctor.
Mm-hmm.
We got everybody vaccinated. I wasn't real popular for that.
Mm-hmm.
We got a MedCap team to come in, and they vaccinated everybody for a couple of things. I forget what they were right offhand. Run a TB test, and also had a dental check.
Okay. Now, when you finished working at the police force, I guess it was like an academy.
I went from the correction center in Hoi An, or correction detention, to Da Nang, and I was an advisor for the in-service police academy at Tin Cha, which was south of Da Nang.
Okay. You mentioned that you conducted operations where you went along as liaison with the National Police. And that, in the event that you encountered American personnel?
Yes.
One of the things you said that one of your jobs would have been to apprehend American personnel caught during those sweeps and return them to military control. Did that actually happen? Did you actually have to apprehend Americans during those sweeps?
Oh, yes.
What were they, why were they away from their units? Were they just AWOL or?
Well, how do I... They were young American males, and they were in desire of female company, companionship.
Okay, all right.
And they would go to the villages and whatnot, and for a fee, I guess that's.
Gotcha. Anybody that was there for anything other than female companionship that you recall?
Yeah. I caught a guy that was a deserter, been a deserter for 4.5 years.
Okay.
I caught a black marketeer.
Mm-hmm.
I caught a lieutenant that was assigned to a military police company.
What was he doing?
Same thing as the rest of the guys were.
Oh, okay. The other guys, that is, seeking companionship.
Yeah, companionship.
Okay.
We caught a money launderer one time. He had $6,000 to $8,000 American greenbacks on him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much MPC he had, and a lot of Piasta.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he cried all the way to jail.
Okay. Anything else interesting happened while you were assigned to either the correctional facility or to the academy?
Well, on the side of the academy, the second weekend I was there,
mm-hmm.
a typhoon came through, and it didn't level the academy, but it did multiple building damage, and then I find out that 3 weeks after the typhoon, I'm having an inspection by the deputy commanding general from 24th Corps, General James Hollingsworth, who, ironically enough, was my DCG while I was in the 1st Infantry Division. And had also been at Aberdeen with me.
Okay.
I did a lot of liaison work with the Navy. I got to know some Navy chiefs real well. I got to know some CVs real well. And they had engineering and skills that I couldn't even think about.
Mm-hmm.
Carpenters, electricians, plumbers. And they were more than willing to come over and not only lend a hand, but to help the Vietnamese. You know, they'd instruct them.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Vietnamese that are at the academy are all Vietnamese police. There are no carpenters out there. We didn't have any carpenters assigned. We had policemen.
Mm-hmm.
Same with electricians, plumbers.
So you have other services pitched in terms of providing both expertise and also training, cross-training them. The Navy, the Seabees, they were volunteering to do this.
Yeah, I'd go talk to them, and they'd get four or five people. You know, they'd ask people to volunteer.
Mm-hmm.
And these guys always wanted, I don't know, I think that they wanted to get out and see what we really did.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And at the academy, did you find, again, the Vietnamese were very receptive to you as an advisor? And
very receptive. Also, eager to please.
Mm.
The one that spoke English as well as I spoke Vietnamese was Captain Jung. Rather tall gentleman. And he thought that I should live in his house with him. He, you know, every place we went, he always ensured that I had a bodyguard.
Wow.
And I told him, I said, Dai Wee, I don't need a bodyguard. Oh, if anything happened to me, my chief will cut my head off. I said, what? And he said, if anything would happen to my Kovan, which that's Vietnamese for advisor, he said his chief had told him, if anything happens to your Kovan, I'm going to cut your head off.
Wow.
So, I don't know if he did or not. It may have been just something to make his make me feel better.
Did, and nothing ever happened to you your second tour? You didn't get injured or anything?
Yeah, I got shot at a couple times.
Yeah. Did the compounds that you worked in, the prison or the academy, did they ever get mortared or rocketed or anything like that?
Well, at Zion, at Quang Nam, the detention center took three direct mortars one night.
Mm-hmm.
The MACV compound took a lot of mortars.
Mm-hmm.
We had three or four people medevaced for wounds from MACV.
Okay. But that was not a normal occurrence, or was it?
Yeah, about once a month, Charlie let us know that he was still out there.
Okay. Yeah, so that's not very frequent, you know, once a month.
Nah, it. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't always mortars. One night they threw a 75 pack howitzer at us.
Wow.
And it hit a truck parked at the local PF compound. And it just so happened that was one night that the PF advisors had come to MACV where we were having a show that night.
Mm-hmm.
And he was up there. Anyway, when that hit that corner of that truck, it put shrapnel all through the mobile home that they usually lived in.
Mm-hmm.
If they'd have been there, it would have killed them all.
Wow. Okay.
And that was the night that I went to combat in shower shoes, a flak vest, a pair of shorts, and a helmet. And we wound up in a bunker with all the female entertainers. You know, funny things happen, but a thing went off. I just come out of the shower.
Mm-hmm.
I grabbed my rifle and my stuff, and into the bunker I went. And, of course, I was one of the first ones to take up a firing position. And pretty soon was all in there, and this colonel came in, and he said, everybody okay? Yeah, and he starts having a little roll call in there. And this gal lights a cigarette. She said, there's three guys in here in their shorts.
Mm-hmm.
And the colonel said, what you guys doing in your shorts? And I said, sir, I heard there's a come as you are party when the first round went off.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, where's you at? I said, I just come out of the shower with a towel wrapped around me. Well, he said, I guess that's acceptable.
Mm-hmm. Let me go ahead and stop this. I'm about to run out of space on this CD, and let me put a new one in real quick.
Okay.
All right, this ends CD number one. All right, this is CD number two of the interview with Mr. Daryl Nelson. All right, now, the incident in the bunker there with the female entertainers, that raises a question for me about, you also mentioned previously the use of some of the Army services and USO and things like that. Did you utilize a lot of those services, and did you see many USO shows while you were in Vietnam, your first and your second tour?
The first tour, I've seen quite a few. To name a few, Bob Hope.
Mm-hmm.
Shook hands with Mr. Hope.
Mm-hmm.
And he waiting on TV or they're going to cancel us. when I was at Fuloy, I met, I'm going to tell you his name, Hugh O'Brien and the Korean Kittens. Mr. O'Brien invited me to a party with after the show.
Mm-hmm.
I was an investigator, and I was part of the entourage security. And he was intrigued by my call sign. My call sign was Gunfighter.
Okay.
And he invited me to a party, and we talked, and I got autographed pictures of him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at Zeon Base Camp, my first tour, and at Lykay, I met a young lady by the name of Nancy Sinatra.
Okay.
And she sang These Boots Are Made for Walking, and seen her show two or three times.
Mm-hmm.
I also, you know, there are certain shows I've seen, some shows I didn't care for. The second tour, I didn't see many shows, big shows, because they were the big names. Like Mr. Hope, when he came back, he gave a show at Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we could go, but, you know, it's a 30-mile, it's a 50-mile ride,
mm-hmm.
and Charlie could own the roads, because I remember these so-called ceasefires. I don't like them. Every time I got hurt, it's been a ceasefire. But we had shows at the compound, at MACV compound. We probably had four or five shows. Oh, over a couple of months. They had USO services. They had classes at the USO. They taught you how to pour gold, you know, so you could make gold jewelry, gold rings, whatnot. They had crafts like leather. They had, you could go sit and read. I'm kind of an avid reader, and I used to go up there, and I'd read four or five books, and I'd take them up, trade them for four or five more. They had first-rate movies. I never attended any, but one time one of the radio operators came back and told me about this movie, and it just so happened that it was playing in Georgia the first week in Atlanta. And they were seeing it in Vietnam 2 days before they seen it in Atlanta.
Okay. Did you find that those services were helpful?
Oh, yeah. It sort of got your mind off what was going on. And relax. I carved a leather, a set of twin leather holsters while I was there. And I still have them around today just for nostalgia, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And what did you think of the actual entertainment that you witnessed in some of the USO shows, you know, Nancy Sinatra and Bob Hope? Did you think that they put on a really good show for the soldiers? Or
they put on excellent shows. And I would be amiss if I didn't say Colonel Martha was one of the best. Martha Ray.
Okay. Did you happen to see any shows that featured Chris Noel?
No, I didn't.
Okay. Anything else you want to add about your first and your second tours?
Just that my second tour was much more productive,
mm-hmm.
much more educational, and I formed longer lasting friendships with the people from the second tour than I did the first tour.
Now, by the people, you mean Americans or Vietnamese or both?
Both.
Okay. Did any of the Vietnamese you worked with come to the United States after 75?
Yep.
Okay.
Captain Young is, excuse me, Mr. Young,
mm-hmm.
and I are supposed to get together September 30th in Anaheim, California.
Oh, wow. The Covan, the Counterparts Reunion?
That's right.
Oh, excellent. Okay, I'll be there.
I'll be there, too.
All right, wonderful. Anybody else that came over?
I understand that young Lou is in the United States. I have never been able to track him down.
Okay. Now, you said you learned a lot more. What were the major lessons that you took away from that second tour?
To be a little more laid back, more patient. Mm-hmm. Listen closer to people. You know, the Americans have this problem. I say we, and I used to be this bad, real bad about it. When somebody'd say something, I'd only hear about half what they said. I didn't pay any attention. I learned to listen very careful to what people told me. I also learned, go the extra mile to help people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I used to think, you know, here it is, here's what you do. Here's your tools, here's your equipment, go do it, I'll come and check on you. You don't do it right, you're in trouble. You don't do that. You give a person, you tell them how to do it, you show them how to do it, you give them the tools, and then you go check on them. And if they're not doing it right, you ask them, did I make a mistake in my explanation? Is there something you don't understand? I think patience is something that it taught me.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting lesson. Do you think that in terms of our strategy and our tactics and how we implemented our strategy and tactics in the war in Vietnam, do you think that we displayed patience?
Speaking from experience, no. Some of our advisors, and I hate to say this, but were the worst offenders. They didn't have any patience. Vietnamese are very patient, and they very, they work things through. They're very inventive, and they will do about anything. But don't be impatient. Don't be overbearing, and above all, don't ever be arrogant with them. If you do, you've lost them.
Okay. Any other major lessons that you took away from the second tour?
Yeah, stay in good physical shape.
Okay. Something in particular that brings that up?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if I've mentioned it before or not, but I started the first prison farm with Lou's help.
Mm-hmm.
In Quang Nam province, and we had to sweep it, and the first time we swept it, we ran into somebody that didn't want to leave, and the fight started, and there wasn't a whole lot of cover out there.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a pretty good run, and after that, I found out if I'm going to be in a combat situation, I'm going to have a good set of legs on me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be able to run, and I'm going to be able to jump, and I'm going to be able to duck.
Okay. All right, well, how was your reception coming back from your second tour?
Well, I came in at McCord Air Force Base.
And what month and year is this now?
I think it was about March of 72, sir.
Okay.
And I came home because I had a growth in my hand, in my ring finger on my right hand, that had broke, and they could not take care of it in Vietnam.
Hmm.
The doctor told me that they usually wound up with something like this, of removing the finger completely. And I said, Doc, that's kind of a match set. I'd like to keep them. And he said, how long do you have to go? And I said, about 44 days. Yeah, he said, we'll send you back. So they sent me back. They sent me, they didn't medevac me. They just gave me an early rotation. And the first place I went was McCord Air Force Base, and I went to when I got there, I immediately went to the hospital that night. Doctor in the emergency room took some x-rays, and he said, do you live close to here? And I said, no, I live in northern Idaho. My family does. And he said, okay. He said, how about if I set you up to have this taken care of at Fairchild Air Force Base in Spokane? And I said, that means I can go home. And he said, that means you can catch the next thing smoking. When I went out the gate, there's some people out there, and they spit at us, and they did different things, and being meek and mild like I am, I got right back in their face. Going out the on a bus, and somebody yelled something, and I yelled right back at them. I told the bus driver, hell, stop. Let's get out and take care of them. Mm-hmm. You know, there's 15 of us non-returnees here, and there's only about 70 of them. Well, it ought to be about right.
Mm-hmm.
He wouldn't do it. The only real problem I had was at the airport in Seattle, SeaTac International, when I went down to get on a Hughes Air West. I don't know if the person was being smart, trying to be funny or what, but she said when I was in uniform and wearing all my decorations like I'm required to. And as I walked up and to go down the gang of the jetway, she said, oh, are you one of those NOM killers? I said, yeah. I got 7 body count in the last 3 days. You want to make it 8? And the crew kind of shied away from me. But I don't know if she was trying to be funny or what, but I just wasn't in the mood for her humor.
Mm-hmm.
Guy at Spokane said something, and I was walking out. I had my wife and my children in tow, and he started to say something, and I said, you know, I think it would be best if you started whistling and walked the other way, and I'm going to do the same. Because if you say what I think you're going to say, we're going to have a problem. And he looked at me and he said, you're serious. And I said, you're about 2 minutes away from an ambulance ride. And he said, you have a good day, and walked off.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like protesters. I would take nothing from them, and I would enjoy nothing more than popping one in right into the ground.
Was this something that you talked about with other soldiers that you came into contact with shortly thereafter?
Oh, yeah, several of us had talked about it when we were changing into our dress uniforms at McCord.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we discussed it. We had a pact. This one guy said, Sarge, you hit somebody, you're allowed to break that thing in your hand worse. I said, what the hell? It'll be worth it. And we agreed. We weren't going to take anything off these people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are Americans. The Vietnamese treated us better. Why should we take this guff from these people?
Mm-hmm. What did you think about that type of activity in terms of, you know, here you are, you've gone to Vietnam twice now to fight for your country, to do the service that you've been called upon to do, and you come back and you've been mistreated twice now?
It bothered me. I didn't know what to think about it. I thought they were all criminals and should be locked up. The people that poured the blood and records and things like that, you know, I thought that should be a capital offense.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And when you finally did make it, well, your surgery, I take it, went well.
Yeah, I went up and seen the doc, and he said, oh, yeah, heard all about you. And he had my x-rays there.
Okay.
And I said, oh? And he said, tell you what. He said, I'm just going to take and open up the finger from the first joint all the way up under the fingernail bed. And he said, I'm going to lay it back and just try to scrape it off. And he said, if that don't work, he said, I'll just bring out the saw and take it off no shorter than I have to.
Mm-hmm.
And he had me check in the hospital on a Monday night, and Tuesday morning they took me into surgery. And Wednesday morning I was released with 7 stitches and a big old shank of steel around my finger.
Mm-hmm. And that did the trick. That worked.
Yeah, there's only one problem with it. I got to be very careful of that. The bone in the end of my finger is probably the size of a pencil lead.
Oh.
And it's got a hole through it.
Okay. And when you went back onto active duty, when you went back to service, and after you recovered from your surgery and you got your leave, was there much talk about, you know, Vietnam and some of the problems that you had encountered upon your return, or did you just kind of just get on with life, get on with your military career?
I just went to West Point, New York, and I just went on with life.
Okay. What did you think about the Paris Peace Accords that came about in January of 73?
I thought we'd sold out the Vietnamese. I thought we'd sold out every American that had been killed over there.
Mm-hmm. And then what did you think about the events as they unfolded in 1974 and 1975 as North Vietnam advanced to South?
Just like I said, told people it would happen. I had a very good friend that was a Vietnamese that worked for Cords. She was a waitress at the Cords restaurant in Da Nang, where we used to eat quite often. And I used to go in there in the afternoon and drink coffee once in a while. And I go in there and there wouldn't be too many people in there. And this young lady was very well educated, and we were talking one time, and she told me that, well, when the Americans leave, you will see a different side of the Army of the Republic of Vietnam. And I said, you bet. I said, you'd be better off with your police force, because most of the Arvins I've seen would run. And her and I used to have long discussions about this, and she thought that the Vietnamese Army, because they'd been so well trained by the Americans and everything, that they would hold up. And I said, no. I said, they're going to roll over this country. It may be 1 year, it may be two. But I said, I don't think it'll last longer than two. Well, I was wrong. It took almost three.
Mm-hmm. Just out of curiosity, when you work with the police, now one of the problems that other soldiers encountered when they were working with Arvin units, they were a lot of communist infiltrators, a lot of Viet Cong or even some North Vietnamese infiltrators into Arvin. Did you find, were there ever any incidences where you had Viet Cong or North Vietnamese infiltrators into the MPs of the Vietnamese police force?
I never did find one.
Okay.
We had one time that we questioned a lot because he had came from the Arvins. And the chief decided, the Da Nang chief of police, sent him back to the Arvins is unacceptable.
Mm-hmm.
He was shaking people down.
Oh.
And there's some things that... my last assignment in Da Nang was as the deputy advisor to the deputy chief of police. And we had just, he had an intelligence section, and they were just getting a good start. And he was one of the first ones that they were looking hard at. But they got rid of him before they could ever make a determination.
Okay. Well, what... how did the war most affect you? I mean, you when you came back from your second tour, you went on with your military career. How did the war affect your career? How did the war affect you personally?
Personally, it made me a lot more cautious. I tried to take a middle-of-the-road approach to everything. My military career, I don't think it hurt. It didn't, didn't make it exceptionally helpful, but it didn't hurt me any. I think it, I can't say that it didn't help me, because I was promoted to E7 above, ahead of my peers, even though they took me out of the military police field to do it.
What? Where did they put you?
Infantry.
Okay. Did you have a? Did you find it difficult to transition from the wartime army to the peacetime army?
Not as hard as I did from the military police to the infantry.
What was hard about that transition?
As a military police NCO, I was never questioned. My superiors, they told me to do something, or said they needed something. I did it, and that was it. My first encounter with the infantry, I had a West Point lieutenant who was younger than me. He was more in the class with the Spec 4s and the PFCs and the young sergeants. He was more or less their buddies. I mean, you know, you're not supposed to fraternize. This guy go out drinking with them. And I made a comment one time about we were getting it, I was putting him in a deuce and a half. And I told the guy, I said, hold the gate while I lock it down up there, you know, put the chain in. He said, why? And I said, so none of you fall out. And I put the strap up, and he said, you don't trust us. I said, I trust everybody. I just don't trust the back of a deuce and a half. And this was a big controversy. They told him I didn't trust him. He told me one night I was in the barracks, and I thought I smelled marijuana. Pretty familiar what marijuana smells like.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to try to track it down. And he told me that wasn't my job, that he'd rather see people use marijuana than booze. Because marijuana, the next day they had a clear head. Booze, they didn't.
How did you deal with that?
Well, they dealt with it for me. They transferred me to another unit as a correctional custody NCOIC.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought that, my God, I died and went to heaven because I had a job that was from 7 to 3 and no extra duties and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Then my first sergeant quit and they made me the first sergeant of the unit. Reality shock.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you didn't really have a difficult time transitioning from Vietnam to the U.S., from wartime to peacetime, but there was a bit of a difficult transition there getting situated in the infantry and then, I guess, well, in the correctional unit, that would have been, or the custody, is that what you said?
Correctional custody.
Correctional
facility.
Custody. Mm-hmm.
That's where the commander will send people.
Mm-hmm.
They stay in their unit during the day,
mm-hmm.
and their off-duty hours is
mm-hmm.
Very close supervision.
Gotcha.
And, again, a slave labor market.
Mm-hmm.
All the painting that needs done on post mm-hmm. and all the raking.
Yeah, all the guys that are given an Article 15 and given correctional duty.
Well, not everybody. But
or something like that.
Yeah, that's part of judicial or non-judicial punishment.
Yeah, okay. What do you think we should take away from the Vietnam War itself as an experience, as a nation? What are the most important lessons we should learn?
If we're going to do something, do it right. Keep the civilians and the politicians out of it. And keep the money people out of it.
Okay.
Anything else? The reason I say that is the Alaska Barge and Tug Company was making $1 million a day. And, of course, we all know who owned the Alaska Barge and Tug Company.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to add?
Well, let's put it this way. I wouldn't go back through my 30-some months in Vietnam for $1 million. I wouldn't take $50 million for my experience.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, if that's, do you have anything else you want to say?
Yeah, I got one thing I'd like to say, and I really mean this from the bottom of my heart. I never thought that I would live to see discrimination in the United States against American soldiers. I am a witness, and I have been discriminated against by the United States government, by the state of Arizona, and by the Mojave County, Arizona. When I say discriminated against, I have been denied employment, where they've taken people that were less qualified, less educated, and put them into the positions. One incident, I made a complaint to the National Labor Relations Board in Washington, D.C. In turn, sent it to an office in Phoenix, Arizona. And a gentleman called me up, and he told me he was going to have it investigated. And I thought it was kind of ironic. He had it was going to have it investigated by the same man I made the complaint against. And I just don't think that Vietnam veterans always get a fair shake. It doesn't really bother me by not working.
Mm-hmm.
I retired from the Army as a Master Sergeant E-8 for 20 years. I have a partial disability. I retired from the state of Alaska as a correctional officer. So I make a sufficient I make a living. I don't make a great living, but I live comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Have you talked to other veterans about this discrimination that you've experienced, and have they experienced similar problems?
Yeah, I've talked to a lot of them, and, you know, it's funny, until the shoe's on your foot and pinching, you never think about it.
Mm-hmm.
In Alaska, I talked to a lot of people, worked in corrections, and they told me about how they were singled out. You know, I thought, yeah, right, you're in jail, so you were singled out. But now, I'm on that side, and I see it.
Mm-hmm.
You're
talking about the prisoners in Alaska, that they were...
They said they were singled out because they were veterans.
Okay.
And now I kind of believe it.
Mm-hmm.
There are people that have a mindset that all Vietnam veterans are drunken, dope, smoking, lazy bums. An incident point is the Saturday before Labor Day, 1996, or 97, I guess it'd be 97, on a Friday, I had an appointment at the Veterans Medical Center at Prescott, and they did a procedure that required that I be giving a sedative and some other things. And I couldn't drive for 24 hours, so I stayed at Prescott that night. The next morning, I got up, Saturday morning, and it was starting to sprinkle rain, and it's about a 100-mile drive back to my residence. As I came over the hill, in Prescott, I seen three Arizona Department of Public Safety, Highway Patrol, whatever they call them, vehicles, white, and some motorcycles, and they were coming down a gravel road. I thought that that might be their headquarters. 7 o'clock is about shift change time. So I was within the speed limit, but I slowed down a couple miles an hour and slipped over into the left lane so that they could go out without, you know, having to stop. I'm aware of what happens when the roads have been dry for a long time and you get just a little bit of rain, they get very slick. Mm-hmm. When I pulled over like that, the individual in one of the cars pulled a laser out and popped it right on my front bumper. And I always say it's because I had a sign there that said, Veteran, Vietnam War, front license plate. Since I wasn't speeding, I didn't care about it. I just continued on my way. A motorcycle officer pulled in behind me, trying to stay in my blind spot, and he followed me from Prescott through Chino Valley, Arizona, probably about 15 miles, trying to stay in the blind spot of my pickup all the time. I counted 7 citable traffic violations the time that he was back there. He never did a thing to any of these other people, to include the one that was passing on a double yellow line and forced us both to the side of the road. He had a mindset that I was a bad guy and he was going to get me. He never stopped me, but he followed me all that distance. Mm-hmm. And all these other things went on around him.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I say there's still prejudice against us.
Mm-hmm. And what about the, you mentioned that there are some of your fellow veterans that live in the Arizona area where you live now, and you have interactions with them on occasion. Have you discussed this with them? Do they display or have they experienced similar problems or discriminations?
Yes, they have, and some of them will admit it.
Yeah.
But some of them won't.
Yeah.
But we have another problem here in Arizona. Everybody here wants to tell what they were in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
The common thing around this area is I was Special Forces, I was a Navy SEAL,
mm-hmm.
or I was a Marine Recon. And I don't know if I put it in my other thing or not, but one night in a local restaurant here that is also a bar, a young man got up and told how he helped raise the flag on Mount Suribachi, and he thought everybody owed him a drink. The only problem is, I'm 59 years old, and when they raised the flag on Mount Suribachi, I was 4 years old, 3 or 4. This guy's 5 years younger than I am. We had a man around town that was quite a local character, claimed to be a gunsmith, claimed to be an ace mechanic, claimed he was a special forces man, testified as an expert witness on weapons in our superior court, and when he had a heart attack, his ex-wife went to the Veterans Administration to try to get help to bury him, and he'd never been in the military.
Yeah, there's a big problem with fraudulent vets, it appears.
Well, I'll tell you what, this place is number one. I thank you for letting me have my say, sir.
Oh, well, thank you very much. It's been my pleasure. And why don't we go ahead and cut this thing off real quick. This ends interview number one with Darrell Nelson.